Welcome back to this, the fourth lecture in the Wyoming Catholic College Distance Learning Series, Points of Light in the Darkness, the Church in the 19th Century. I'm Dr. Jim Tonkwich, your professor for this class. In the United States, as the 19th century opened, while Catholics were not exactly in favor, they could be tolerated, provided they were genteel, hardworking, middle class, and respectable, which, as the century opened, most were, despite their backward, superstitious, idolatrous, theocratic, and despotic religion. Within a few decades, however, the Catholic population changed, and with it, attitudes toward Catholics changed dramatically from tolerant to vicious. In their book, Gotham, A History of New York to 1898, Edwin G. Burroughs and Mike Wallace write, quote, "As New York's Catholic Church changed during the 1820s, became more working class, more militant, more Irish, less middle class, less French and Spanish, less respectable, anxieties and resentments rose in various Protestant quarters. Catholic emancipation in England generated a flood of anti-popery books and tracts decrying the new license. Many of these were exported to New York, where they aggravated local activists. The advent of Charles Finney's revivals exacerbated tensions by generating millennial enthusiasm and heightening denominational aggressiveness. The sudden spurt of Irish Catholic immigration seemed menacing, too, in light of Vatican support for various reactionary European governments. Some believed it signaled an attempt by monarchists and despots to establish a beachhead in New York as a step toward infiltrating and overthrowing the Republic." Close quote. Let's parse that out a bit. You may remember how St. John Henry Newman wrote that in his Protestant days, he, quote, "became most firmly convinced that the Pope was the Antichrist predicted by Daniel, St. Paul, and St. John," close quote. 19th century American revivalist preachers like Charles Finney were equally as convinced and not the least bit shy of saying so. Their addition to Newman's prejudice was the expectation that Christ's second coming was very soon, which meant the ascendancy of the Antichrist, who would come to power before Christ's appearing. And who do you think was the Antichrist? The Pope, of course, along with all his evil minions. As to infiltrating and overthrowing the government, well, it wasn't just crazies who believed and spread that stuff. Lyman Beecher, a prominent Presbyterian clergyman, theologian, and seminary president, warned in his popular 1837 book, Plea for the West, that the Pope, the Austrian Emperor, and assorted European Catholic kings had conspired together to conquer the United States. Catholic immigrants were agents of sedition, and a vast army was already poised to invade the Mississippi Valley under the merciless command of the Jesuits. A magazine called The Protestant Vindicator was founded with one purpose, to expose Catholic, quote, abuses, with special emphasis on convents. Scandalous fiction about Catholics, partly coming out of England after the Catholic Emancipation Act of 1829, seasoned the mix. Consider some of these popular titles from the 1830s. 6 months in a convent. Maria Monk's awful disclosures of the Hotel Dieu in Montreal. Further disclosures. The escape of Sister Frances Patrick, another nun, from the Hotel Dieu. In the rather straight-laced 1800s, these and similar titles were an acceptable form of pornography. Physical and sexual abuse, seduction, homosexuality, kidnappings, forced conversions, the murder of infants born to nuns, secret underground dungeons, tunnels between convents and rectories, daring escapes, and Protestant heroes were all standard themes in the anti-Catholic fiction of the day. Crazy conspiracy stuff from long ago, right? But did you know that in August 2022, an article in The Atlantic, a very respectable journal, cited rosary beads as a symbol of violent extremism? So there really is nothing new under the sun. Anyway, back to the 1800s. If the new Catholic immigrants had been middle and upper class people, fewer in number, perhaps things wouldn't have come to a head. But the Catholic immigrants who were the most numerous and troublesome were the poor Irish. In 1830, the population of New York City was about 200,000. Consider, in 1827, more than 20,000 Irish came to America. In 1835, that number had increased to about 30,000 every year. Now, not all of those Irish ended up in New York, but many did. And the city swelled with Irish Catholics, even as the Catholic population of the United States grew 60% from 1820 to 1830. William J. Stern, writing in City Journal, summed up the situation. The new immigrants were mostly Irish, impoverished, ignorant, unskilled country folk, with nothing in their experience to prepare them for success in the urban environs to which they were flocking. And flock they did into seedy Manhattan neighborhoods like Sweeney's Shambles and the notorious Five Points. Houses built for single families could have multiple families and other people living all in grinding poverty. Jobs, particularly after the economic bust of 1837, were hard to come by, and the only ones for which the Irish were qualified were at the bottom: chimney sweeps, brickmakers, rag pickers, low skill and low pay positions in tanneries, shipyards, slaughterhouses, and so on, digging through the sewers, hoping to find valuables accidentally dropped and lost in there. Even if they worked somewhere where there were advancement opportunities, Irish Catholics knew that they were not on the short list for promotions. And even to get these menial jobs, there was fierce competition with unskilled U.S.-born poor, the nativists, and with free blacks. Since a sense of belonging and self-worth were unlikely to come from work, young men joined gangs, and gangs had territories, and territories had to be defended from other gangs. Violence was rampant in New York. Irish girls and women could find domestic work as cooks, washerwomen, or maids in the homes of the wealthy and in hotels, but there was a much easier and more profitable way to make money. William Stern notes that at a time when New York's population was less than 600,000, quote, an estimated 50,000 Irish prostitutes, known in flash talk as nymphs of the pavement, walked the city in 1850, and Five Points alone had as many as 17 brothels, close quote. While prostitution at the time was common all over New York, 50,000 Irish prostitutes in a city with a population of less than 600,000 is an outrageous number. Stern goes on to fill out our picture. Quote, illegitimacy reached stratospheric heights, and tens of thousands of abandoned Irish kids roamed or prowled the city's streets. Violent Irish gangs with names like the 40 Thieves, the B-Boys, the Roach Guard, and the Chichesters brought havoc to their neighborhoods. The gangs fought one another and the nativists, but primarily they robbed houses and small businesses and trafficked in stolen property. Over half the people arrested in New York in the 1840s and 1850s were Irish, so that police vans were dubbed paddy wagons. And episodes of mob violence in the streets were called Donnybrooks, after a town in Ireland. Close quote. Such was Irish life in New York until it ended, most often by tuberculosis, alcohol abuse, or violence. The average life expectancy among the poor Irish at the time was less than 40 years. This is not to say that there were not successful, capable, highly skilled Irish in New York. There were, but the vast majority lived in economic, social, spiritual, and personal disorder. Back in Ireland, there had been two major rebellions by Catholics against British rule, one in 1798 and the other in 1803. The result was martial law, in addition to all the other restrictions to which Irish Catholics were subject, including no chance of education. Patrick and Margaret Hughes, while being successful tenant farmers, wanted something better for their children, including young John Joseph, who was born in 1797. In three stages, beginning in 1816, the Hughes family emigrated to the United States. Young John arrived alone in Baltimore in 1817 after a harrowing voyage from Belfast. After a few years in Baltimore, a city relatively friendly to Catholics, the family moved to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, down the road from Emmitsburg, the home of both Mount St. Mary's Seminary and of Elizabeth Ann Seton and her Sisters of Charity. It's hard to say when John Hughes felt called to the priesthood, but after working for several years as a gardener at the seminary, he was convinced. After attempting several times to begin studies and being turned down, Mother Seton finally broke the barrier that allowed a poor Irishman with little formal education the opportunity to train for the priesthood. John Hughes was ordained in 1826 and went to work in the Diocese of Philadelphia. In 1837, it was clear that the Bishop of New York, John Dubois, needed help. He was French, and so the Catholics with continental European ancestry thought he was great. But he had no traction at all with the Irish, even with the few Irish who managed to attend Mass. In addition, he was 72 with failing health. Much to Dubois' chagrin, Rome chose John Hughes as his coadjutor bishop. Soon, Hughes was running the diocese, and upon Dubois' death in 1842, he took over as Bishop of New York, later Archbishop. So far, we've talked about two canonical saints, St. John Vianney and St. John Henry Newman. Another canonized saint, Thérèse of Lisieux, is waiting in the wings. John Hughes, on the other hand, was no saint. He often came across as a pugnacious Irish politician because on many levels he was a pugnacious Irish politician. He pushed to get his way, often caused offense needlessly, claimed to be apolitical while he engaged in all sorts of politics, and picked fights with journalists in print, and could be a bit shady in some of his dealings. Author John Kelly calls him, quote, a cleric of first-rate mind and third-rate temperament. Seeing the little cross Hughes drew before signing his name, a journalist critical of the bishop dubbed him Dagger John. And there's a reason the name stuck. Hughes was accused of seeking power and holding that power over others rather than letting them take care of themselves. But as Hughes' biographer, John Lowry, notes, indeed, in 1838, Hughes was a flock that could not take care of itself. And that flock existed in the midst of a culture that was decidedly hostile, even violent. From the point of view of a Catholic priest or anyone who cared about the spiritual and physical well-being of others, the New York Hughes came to was a nightmare, scarcely imaginable today, in religious and civic terms, in educational and hygienic terms. Close quote. And in the midst of that nightmare, that darkness, Hughes, a rather noisy, pushy point of light, set to work. Reflecting on his own life, Hughes knew that the Irish would be stuck in the rut of poverty, violence, and sickness unless they were educated. Education, he knew from personal experience, opened the door to the vast opportunities America had to offer. Now, there were public schools, but those schools were, quote, non-sectarian, close quote, which, in the language of the day, meant that they were lowest common denominator Protestant. That is, while they were not Baptist or Presbyterian or Methodist, the sectarian issues to be dealt with at home, there was no question on which side of the Reformation they stood. The Bible read at school was the Protestant King James Version, and no amount of protest from Catholics made anyone budge a millimeter on that. Public school teachers were nearly all native-born Protestants who had a low opinion of all immigrants and a particular disdain for Irish Catholics. Besides, public schools in the impoverished neighborhoods the Irish lived in were few and far between. School libraries contained history books paid for with tax dollars with a blatantly anti-Catholic bias. For example, in one popular textbook, elementary school students were taught, quote, a part of Italy is governed by the Pope, who makes such laws for the people as he pleases, though often very wicked. The Catholics say he can do no wrong. Lowry adds that while some textbooks and library books were more moderate, quote, Catholicism was always about autocratic government, image worship, benighted foreigners, and slavish obedience. Hughes tried his best to bring about a change. He sought to have public money set aside to purchase books with the Catholic side of the story. He enlisted the help of then governor of New York, William Seward, and he lobbied the state assembly to break the nativist hold on public education by providing public funds for parochial schools. Finally, he gave up. You know, we complain today about not enough money, too few priests, too few religious helping in our communities and schools. If only we had more money, more priests, more nuns and friars. John Hughes regularly said the same thing. There were never enough Catholic schools or enough religious to staff them. About half the Catholic children in New York attended public schools, despite the entrenched anti-Catholic bias and indoctrination. About a quarter went to the few overcrowded Catholic schools, and about a quarter attended no school at all. Hughes found this intolerable and worked tirelessly to found and fund more Catholic schools that could accommodate both those attending no school and those attending schools where their faith was disparaged. By 1854 in Manhattan, there were 28 schools with about 10,000 students. By 1864, Hughes' effort had boosted that number to 43 parochial schools with 15,000 students, and that wasn't enough, but it was an enormous amount of progress in a mere 10 years. Beyond schooling for children, in 1840, Hughes founded St. John's Seminary. A year later, he founded St. John's College that became Fordham University. This way he could educate his own priests rather than importing them from Europe, a regular and necessary practice. And he could educate young men not only for the priesthood, but for the law, for medicine, for other professions, thereby creating a Catholic middle class. As with his parochial schools, Hughes worked on a shoestring, constantly worrying about money and working to raise more. The need for priests in particular was huge, because the need for conversion and catechesis was huge. Most of his immigrant Irish flock was unchurched. The Irish potato famine began in 1845 and resulted in not only economic collapse, but social collapse as well. Those who didn't die of starvation did their best to leave before they died of starvation. Between 1845 and 1860, 2 million Irish crossed the Atlantic, most of them in what were called coffin ships, packed into holds with narrow sleeping shelves and no bathroom facilities, can you imagine? Filth, disease, rape, and death, a death rate even higher than that of the slave ships, was the result. But still, the Irish risked all and came to this country for one overwhelming reason. They needed to eat. Those who were ambitious and able landed in New York and headed west. Regarding the rest, Hughes himself wrote, quote, "The destitute, the disabled, the broken down, the very young, the very old, having reached New York, stay. Those who stay are predominantly the scattered debris of the Irish nation," close quote. While probably baptized rather than being Christianized, many of the Irish kept pre-Christian Celtic beliefs, practices, and traditions. How could it have been otherwise, given the English restrictions on priests and on Catholic education in Ireland? In New York, despite the fact that in 1850 there was only one priest for 4,500 Catholics, John Hughes set out to bring about a religious revival among his flock. Being Irish, Hughes understood the immigrants and tailored the ministry of his diocese to their needs. Hughes believed their deplorable condition had much to do with past oppression by the English. He also believed that what is past is past. That was Ireland. This is America. It was not the time or the place to grieve over victimhood. It was the time and the place for a very Catholic idea: personal responsibility. William Stern notes that Hughes put an emphasis on confession, quote, "a sacrament not widely popular today and unknown to many of the Irish who emigrated during the famine, most of whom had never received any religious education. The practice had powerful psychological consequences. You cannot send a friend to confession for you, nor can you bring an advocate into the confessional. Once inside the confessional, you cannot discuss what others have done to you, but must state clearly what you yourself have done. It is the ultimate taking of responsibility for one's actions, and it taught the Irish to focus on their own role in creating their misfortune," close quote. It also, as you and I know, provided an opportunity for spiritual direction and catechesis. The priest didn't just listen to the penitent's sins, he offered counsel and related that counsel to the truths of the faith, urging the penitent to change attitudes, ideas, and behavior. That behavior, of course, included sexual behavior. Living and sleeping conditions were crowded with multiple families, multiple people sharing small spaces. Not good for chastity. I've already pointed out that among women, the career of prostitution was by far the most lucrative, with work in saloons and taverns a close second. Promiscuity seemed inevitable. Yet prostitution, visiting prostitutes, promiscuity, out-of-wedlock childbearing, were out of bounds for Catholics. You know, that was a tough sell in old New York, as it is today in present-day New York, or Dallas, or Seattle, or Lander. John Hughes went about making the case anyway. Hughes and his priests held the line, and over time, Catholic ideas about marriage, family, and sex caught on, along with a new respect for women and self-respect in women. Hughes created ways to help the Irish get jobs, real jobs. As a bishop and as an individual, despite money problems, he had an open wallet to those in need. And he did all he could to help rescue the tens of thousands of vagrant children who wandered the city. Let me mention one other project in closing, a project that sums up Hughes, at least for me. Hughes, perhaps not for the purest of motives, he was intent on proving something to the Protestants. On August 15th, 1858, laid the cornerstone for St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. It was to be a Gothic masterpiece. As Hughes laid the cornerstone, he said he envisioned a cathedral, quote, that may be worthy of our increasing numbers, intelligence, and wealth as a religious community. And at all events, worthy as a public architectural monument of the present and prospective crowns of this metropolis of the American continent, close quote. The undertaking had a staggering price tag that, needless to say, more than doubled before it was finished. Money problems, resulting in material problems and labor problems, led to years of fits and starts in the construction. Then the Civil War came along and halted construction completely. The cathedral was finally completed in 1879, 15 years after Hughes died. Now, we think of Fifth Avenue between 50th and 51st streets as crowded Midtown Manhattan with Rockefeller Center right there across the street. In Hughes' day, that block was barely in the city at all. It was still rural. It was still wilderness. Yet Hughes knew that, being on an island, the only way the city could grow was north. The wilderness spot he chose, he knew, would become the middle of town, which is just where he wanted a cathedral bearing the name of St. Patrick. Just as Hughes had a vision for that cathedral in what was the middle of nowhere, he had a vision for the Irish who comprised the vast majority of his flock. As bishop, John Hughes was faced with a people who were barely a people, a people who were barely civilized, a people who were barely Christian. And yet he saw beyond that and labored for their education, for their economic advancement, for their physical welfare, and above all, for their deep down faithfulness to Jesus Christ and to the Catholic faith. Just before Hughes died, New York witnessed the draft riots in which the Irish, seeing the injustice of the newly passed law to swell the Union Army with them, turned New York into a war zone, finally quelled by the Union Army, fresh from their victory at Gettysburg. John Hughes, it was clear, did not solve all the problems of the New York Irish. Yet, as William Stern points out, the 1863 draft riots were the last gasp of a dying Irish culture of violence and destruction. Where half the arrests in New York in the 1840s and 1850s had been Irish miscreants, By the 1880s and 1890s, that figure dropped to 10%. Instead, Stern notes, quote, "The Irish were the pillars of the criminal justice system. Three-quarters of the police force was Irish. The Irish were the prosecutors, the judges, and the jailers." Widespread drug and alcohol abuse faded, along with prostitution and promiscuity. New York's Irish, writes Stern, became known by the later part of the 19th century as a churched people, often chided by the press for their puritanical attitudes. No, Dagger John Hughes was not a saint. But he was a bright, bright point of light as the church made its way through a troubling time in the troubling 19th century in the United States. Next week, we'll head back across the Atlantic and into the Mediterranean to Rome as we consider another unlikely point of light, Pope Leo XIII. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tomkowicz.